So another minute on the quiz. So make sure your names are on them. Want to send them this away? So the first question is the part about finding the altitude, and for that you really want to draw a meridian. That's the line in the sky that goes from north to the north celestial pole through zenith and back through south. So here's north, here's the north celestial pole, here's zenith, and here's south, and here I am standing under zenith. And in order to make this work, you need to remember that the altitude of the north celestial pole, the angle above the northern horizon, is equal to your latitude, which is in this case 50 degrees. And the celestial equator, since it's perpendicular to the north celestial pole, it's going to miss zenith also by its latitude. So that's 50 degrees. Betelgeuse is a declination of 8 degrees. That means it's north of the celestial equator by 8 degrees, and the altitude is the angle above the nearest horizon, which sometimes is the southern horizon, sometimes is the northern horizon. In this case, the closest angle is to the southern horizon, and there are lots of ways of getting that angle from the diagram. What kind of immediately occurs to me is that since zenith has to be straight up, has to be 90 degrees up, and this is 50 degrees, the angle to get to the celestial equator has to be 40 degrees, right? Which I get, of course, by subtracting 50 from 90. And then I need to go an additional 8 degrees. So 40 to get here plus 8, 48 degrees. Okay. So if the declination of that star were more, it would be pushed past zenith, and then we'd be finding the angle to the northern horizon. If we were in the southern hemisphere, then the whole thing is shifted the other way. The north celestial pole is below the equator, the south celestial pole comes up, and the celestial equator would be over here. So lots of ways of moving around this diagram. Time of day. So the start of the time of day is to figure out where the sun is, because we know where the sun is at one particular time, namely noon. The sun should be on the meridian. And there's that kind of chart you should memorize that says, for example, that, well, let's take, September 21, December 21, those are kind of the two endpoints. The right ascension of the sun is 12 hours on the equinox, and it's going to be 18 hours on the solstice. And we can kind of pick either one. Remember, 2 hours per month. So if we go backwards 1 month, it's going to be 2 hours off of 18 or 16. If we go forward 2 months from September, it's still going to be 16. So either way, the right ascension of the sun on this date is going to be 16 hours. And that's going to be on the meridian at noon. So if the sun is at 16 hours or so, about there, and we want to get to Betelgeuse, it's a long way either way, right? We can either move forward in time or we can move backwards in time, but either way, it's a long chart. So might as well go forward in time. So if we make this little chart that has the time of day and the right ascension on meridian, what we know is that we've got at noon, we've got the sun's right ascension of 16 hours. And we want to move forward until Betelgeuse is on the meridian at 5 hours, 55 minutes. Or we could go backwards, but I decided to go forwards. So if we start to go forwards, this is going to be 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, which is exactly the same as 0. And then we start out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 6 is a little bit past it. The corresponding times are going to be 1 p.m., 2 p.m., 3 p.m., 4 p.m., 5 p.m., 6 p.m., 7 p.m., 8 p.m., 9 p.m., 10 p.m., 11 p.m., 12 midnight, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., so 1:55 a.m. Okay. Everyone get 10 points this time. Get a shot at getting 15 points next time. And probably after that, you know, next week, Thursday, have maybe a matching quiz on that vocabulary sheet. Then the week after that, we've got our first exam. Kind of next week is the last possible starting time for Home Lab 2. And of course, it's cloudy now, right? So as expected, you need lots of days of hoping for a clear sky in order to get a clear sky to do those home labs. Questions? So the aim of yesterday and a good part of today is just to describe what's going on in the sky. Not with any particular model of how it comes about, but just in order to get a handle on the phenomena that occur. And kind of the important thing to remember is that for most objects, something very simple is happening. So all of the visible stars, and of course all of the invisible stars, but the Greeks, of course, couldn't see the invisible stars. All those stars seem to be moving exactly uniformly around the North Celestial Pole. The North Celestial Pole is itself pretty much fixed, but over tens of thousands of years, it's slowly moving in a big circle that has a radius of 23.5 degrees. That's called precession. So over the centuries, it's noticeable. If you read Aristotle on these topics, he says that too bad there isn't a bright star near the North Celestial Pole to mark it. And there wasn't in his day, but there is today. We're at a situation now where Polaris is very close to the North Celestial Pole. Millennia from now, that won't be the case, as it wasn't in Aristotle's time. Okay, so you start out with a very easy explanation. Everything's going around in a circle counterclockwise. And then you notice that there are 7 objects that have more complicated motion. So the Greeks called these wanderers, which is translated as planets. Some of these things we wouldn't call planets these days, but the Greeks called all of these objects that had unusual motions, not like the vast majority, planets. And the plan is to kind of go and talk about exactly what you would see if you followed these planets. So we're starting with the sun, because the sun has the most nearly regular motion. It moves almost uniformly on the ecliptic, takes 1 year to go around the celestial sphere. And we said the fact that it's moving almost uniformly, as opposed to exactly uniformly, is what leads to the complications on the analemma. So the not exactly uniform motion of the sun, again, all this was known 2,000 years ago. Important for people who are making sundials. The moon also moves almost uniformly on a great circle, which is not the ecliptic, but is close to the ecliptic. The great circle that the moon is moving at gradually moves around. So over 18 years, the intersection points between that great circle and the ecliptic, there are always two intersection points diagonally opposite between any two great circles. They're gradually shifting around on the ecliptic or on this path. So on our SEO01s, we have the path for the sun. We don't have the path for the moon because it would change over the period of time that that publisher plans to publish that map. So an eclipse happens when the sun and the earth and the moon are all lined up, and that can only happen at the intersection points between the orbit of the moon, as it were, and the orbit of the sun, at these points that are called the nodes. If the moon and the sun are at the same node, then we're going to have a solar eclipse, and if the moon and the sun are at opposite nodes, then we're going to have a lunar eclipse. So again, kind of the picture you should have. Right, so in this version, well, I might as well twist it so it's more or less like the one that's over there. So here I have, I guess it wants to be twisted like this. Here I have the sun's light coming in from the left, and here I have the shadow of the earth, and here I can move around the moon, except now, I guess if I go like that, I can move around the moon. And of course, the shadow of the moon should be going away from the sun. So as we have the moon going around in its orbit, we have the possibility that the moon and the sun are in the same direction, in which case it turns out that the shadow of the moon just barely hits the surface of the earth with a relatively small black dot that is the pure shadow of the moon. In a spot like this, which is called the preumbral, what you're going to have is a little bit of the sun blocked out, not all of it. So this is, in this case, we'd have a partial eclipse of the sun. So only in this relatively small black dot would we have a total eclipse of the sun, where the sun is totally blocked by the moon. And of course, what's going to happen is, more than anything else, the earth is going to spin, so that black dot is not going to be in a fixed location very long. So kind of solar eclipses where the sun goes dark last a matter of minutes. On the other hand, if we have the moon and the sun in opposite directions as viewed from the earth, the moon can move into the shadow of the earth. And the earth is roughly 3 times bigger than the moon, so it fully covers the moon for a wide range of possibilities. So in this case, everyone on the dark side of the earth can see this moon, and it takes hours for the moon to move through this shadow. So, relatively speaking, in terms of actually seeing it, lunar eclipses are a whole lot easier than to see solar eclipses. Right? To see a solar eclipse, you usually have to go visit the spot on Earth where the dot is hitting. Say again? So you don't see the moon. Well, so what you see in a lunar eclipse, and there are nice pictures of it in the book, is you see something taking a bite out of the sun. So initially, of course, you see a full sun, and then you see, it's not all there. You can't see any features of the moon that's blocking it out because you're looking at the black side of it, and it's also pretty bright outside. And then as time goes on, that black part gets more and more and more, until finally you have just a little sliver of sun, a nearly complete eclipse. And then there's finally what's called the diamond ring effect, where you have just the one last dot of the sun that's being illuminated. And then that goes dark. And when the sun is totally blocked, it turns out that the atmosphere of the sun is visible. So it gets dark outside, like sunset. And you can then see the much less luminous atmosphere of the sun, so you now see kind of a black dot that's in the middle of kind of a whitish halo. The sun has storms that are going on in its atmosphere, and it turns out for special reasons the storms are often tinted red. So you may see cases where essentially the clouds of those storms are peaking above the horizon of the moon, so there'll be like a red dot there.
Does that mean there's always a solar eclipse somewhere on the Earth? Or is it
So you have to have the moon and the sun at these nodal points, right? Because otherwise the moon is going to miss the sun by this 5 degrees. So the only times you can, so if the intersection point of the moon's orbit and the sun's orbit are say there and there, only when the sun is at those locations, which is going to be twice a year, could you have an eclipse. But typically there are going to be two eclipses per year then, for some place on the globe. More questions? So some kind of early evidence about how this all works is if we plot the time of year, right? So here's January, February, March, April, May, June, July, for various years. So here we have solar eclipses and here we have lunar eclipses. And you can see, of course, in order to have any sort of eclipse, the sun has to be at one of these nodes. So we often have solar and lunar eclipses half a month apart. You can see that they don't occur at exactly the same time of year. Right? So if we had an eclipse when the sun was here, the next year maybe we'll have an eclipse there. And this is caused by the fact that the orbit of the moon is gradually changing. Right? So typically what's going to happen is the moon's orbit is going to be inclined by this 5 degrees, and the shadow is going to miss the sun. It's going to miss the Earth. Here we have a full moon that's not going to go through the shadow of the Earth. Only when we have this line of nodes phenomena can we have actual eclipses. So the fact that the season in which we have when we can have eclipses changes, that tells us that the moon's orbit is gradually shifting. These intersection points are gradually shifting back, which means that the great circle that is the path of the moon on the celestial sphere has to be changing. Yeah, if you count the number of years it takes to go through one of these cycles, it's about 18 years. So gradually, the location of those nodes is changing, and so we get eclipses at different times of year. And those are called the eclipse seasons. Okay, so again, all this was figured out by the Greeks 2,000 years ago. Kind of no surprise. So other lunar sorts of phenomena that are a little bit tricky is this difference between the synoptic and the sidereal period for the moon's orbit, as it were, around the celestial equator. So what's the difference between these two? The sidereal period is the actual time it takes for the moon, which started, say, here on the celestial sphere, to go through its cycle and be back to there. So that's the real time it takes for the moon to complete an orbit around the Earth. The other time is a lot easier to measure. It's the time it takes to go from, say, full moon to full moon, or from new moon to new moon. And that's a little bit longer because the sun is a moving target. So if we start out with a new moon, with the moon and the sun at the same position, as time goes on, the sun is going to move, and the moon is going to have to make more than a full revolution in order to, again, be in the new phase. Okay, so the sidereal period, 27 and a third days, is a little bit shorter than the synoptic period. That's the 29 and a half days. And of course, it's the 29 and a half days, the obvious period that matches, approximately speaking, our month. Okay. So the other and probably most prominent feature of the moon is this, the fact that sometimes we don't see much of a moon and sometimes we see a full moon, that the moon seems to go through phases. And you really need to understand how this all works. So I've kind of reproduced crudely the picture over here. Here's kind of a bigger picture. So there are lots of details here. Of course, if the sun is over here in the far right, notice that, of course, the white side of the moon is always going to point towards the sun. And also notice, of course, that from this godlike point of view, the moon always looks the same. But for somebody on Earth, it's going to look different, right? So if you're going to look at this new moon, you're not going to see it, right? Because you're facing the black side of the moon. You can see that this moon is going to be on the meridian at noon, right? Because noon is when the sun is on the meridian. So the sun and the moon are going to be on meridian at noon. If you think about it, the Earth is rotating this way, the moon is rotating this way. This is going to be sunset when we go from light to dark. This is halfway around, so this is going to be midnight. Here we go from dark to light, so this is going to be sunrise. So at sunset, if you think about what our horizon is going to look like, we can see any of these waxing phases. We're going to see the moon close to the sun at sunset. If we're in a crescent phase, we're going to see the sun is right out this way. We're going to see the angle between the moon and the sun being 90 degrees here at first quarter, more than 90 degrees for these waxing gibbous phases, and the full moon and the sun are 180 degrees apart. Now for the phases that are most easily seen at sunrise, right, so there's the horizon. Those are the phases that we can see most easily at sunrise. Those are cases where the moon is catching up to the sun, so the angle between the sun is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So these are all waning phases. So here's a waning gibbous phase. Again, it's gibbous because if you think about what you could see from the Earth, you'd just see a sliver of black. You'd be seeing mostly white. Here we have a third quarter phase where you'd see half of the moon bright and half of the moon dark. Here we would just see this little thin crescent as viewed from Earth. Okay, so here are kind of the standard way these things look in the northern hemisphere. Of course, these things are going to get rotated around depending upon exactly where the sun and the moon are in space. But what's always true is that the white points towards the sun. If you think about making a great circle route, shoot an arrow from this bow, you have to hit the sun. Okay, so this is really what Home Lab 1 is about, seeing all of those moons and seeing how they're going on in the sky. So you should be able to state where in the sky these phases can be observed and what they would look like. Questions? So I want to, at this point, make a slight distinction. So lots of times you've heard me say that the celestial sphere makes one rotation per day. Well, it isn't exactly the case. The celestial sphere actually takes 23 hours, 56 minutes to make a rotation. So if you think about that, what that means, in 24 hours, a star would have made a full rotation and a bit more. So if a star was there tonight, 24 hours later, the same time on your watch, it's going to have gone a little bit more towards the west. The same time the next day, it's going to be moving a little bit more to the west. So day after day after day, at the same time of day, the stars are going to be shifting around from east to west. And of course, every day they're rising in the east and setting in the west at a much faster rate. So because the celestial sphere rotation is not 24 hours, this little bit is going to accumulate over the months. So the stars that you would see at night in the winter are generally speaking going to be different from the stars that you're going to see at night during the summer, because they would have set. But every star is going to cross the meridian every day because the rate of rotation is pretty much the same as 24 hours.
So when they created time, why didn't they adjust it so it would be exact?
Well, so we're not off by 4 minutes. So you can imagine what would happen if we did set our watches so that one cycle of the celestial sphere was 23 hours, 56 minutes. So that would mean that at 9 p.m., the stars would always be at exactly the same place, but but the sun wouldn't. Right? So we don't care so much about getting the stars in the same place. We care about having the sun on the meridian at noon. And the sun's a moving target. So we need to have 24 hours in our rotation because the thing needs to make more than one rotation to catch up to the sun. Because the sun is moving along that way. Yes. So you can. So the star, it doesn't go as black as, say, it would be at midnight because part of the atmosphere may be illuminated in your area. But you can see bright stars during a solar eclipse. And in particular, what you can usually see are the planets. So you remember I asked that question long ago about what planets would be visible at noon if it were dark outside. So those are the planets that you would typically see. And the planets, as we'll say, maybe today, maybe tomorrow, that you almost always see are Mercury and Venus, because they're never very far from the sun. More questions? Okay, so this stuff about phase is important, and it tends to cause people problems. So we've got this kind of application that is designed to help you figure out how this all works, how these things are all interconnected. So I've got, and you can go to this spot. The easiest way to get to this spot, if you want to play with it yourself, is to just go to astro.unl, which is the University of Nebraska at Lincoln.edu, and from there you'll see various links that'll take you to these to this lunar phase simulator. Okay, so if we just start this animation, you can see that guy going through morning and noon and evening and midnight. And you can see here it's going day and night. And of course, what's happening with time is the angle between the moon and the sun is increasing. Right? So sunrise, moonrise. A little bit longer sunrise, moonrise. And what's happening as time goes on is we're seeing more and more of the illuminated face of the moon. One thing I don't like about this simulation is that this is showing things in an upright fashion. Obviously, the moon is twisting around on the sky, and so you're going to get that same moon oriented in different ways at different times of year. So now we have basically a full moon that is setting as the sun rises and rising as the sun sets. It's not much visible during the day, but it's pretty visible at night. And in particular in the morning. Okay, so the moon is now kind of catching up to the sun. So the angle between the moon and the sun is now decreasing. Moon up, sun up. This sort of guy is going to be particularly visible at sunrise. The crescent is waning. We're getting back down to something approaching the new moon phase when we have the moon and the sun in pretty much the same direction. Now, remember that they're not in exactly the same direction because they are the orbit of the moon that the moon follows is inclined by about 5 degrees from the orbit that is the ecliptic. Okay, so if you play with this, you can set up lots of sort of situations. So I can put my guy here at sunrise. Right? So there's the sun in this picture just rising. And I can think about various sorts of moons. So here is a waning gibbous phase, and you can see that this moon is going to be visible in the far west as the sun is rising. And as we get to, say, a third quarter phase moon, that moon is going to be on the meridian more or less as the sun is rising. And we have these thin crescent phases kind of like that. Okay. Questions about how the moon phase works? The most important thing is the angle between the sun and the moon, right? So the angle between the sun and the moon now is there is the direction towards the sun and there's the direction to the moon, and this little angle here, that's the angle between the sun and the moon that you could measure just fine by pointing at the two objects. Okay, so it's something like this that is the quiz that's due for tomorrow, where we're picking out phases of the moon on a diagram that is similar to this one down here, which is maybe a little bit hard to interpret always because it's an attempt to draw something in two dimensions that's really three dimensions. Questions on how the moon works. Here's, you know, another sort of picture to kind of remind you about how the eclipses are going to work. Depending upon where you are compared to the shadow of the moon, you're going to see various things. So right at B, you're going to see the moon exactly covering up the sun. And here we have the atmosphere of the sun being particularly visible. If we're deeper inside the shadow, the moon is going to look bigger because we're closer to it, so you can compare A and B, and now it's going to more than cover up the sun. If you were literally right at B, the eclipse would just take an instant, right, as the rotation of the Earth carried you along. So you want to be at a place like B, or excuse me, like A, where you have a reasonable length of time where the sun is fully obscured. If the shadow of the moon misses the Earth, as in C, then we're going to get this sort of situation where the moon doesn't exactly cover up the sun. So these are not very impressive sights, because if any piece of the sun is available, it's going to be bright outside, and you're not going to be able to see the stars. This is called an annular eclipse. And it turns out about half of the eclipses are annular eclipses. And that's because the distance between the Earth and the sun varies by a little bit. So if we happen to have a situation where the moon is in its close part of its orbit to the Earth, then we're going to have a nice long total eclipse. If we happen to be 180 degrees away from that, where the moon is relatively far from the Earth, then we'll just have an annular eclipse. So roughly speaking, we're going to have two solar eclipses per year. One of them will probably be an annular eclipse, and one of them will probably be a total eclipse. If you're at a spot like D, and of course if you're in the path of totality, that'll be the situation before the Earth spins you into the dot that is black, you'll see this sort of situation. You won't actually see the moon because you're looking at the black side of it. You'll just see this little crescent sun. And when I use the word see, maybe I should be a little bit careful. You don't want to look at that with your eye. If any piece of the sun is available, it will kill the retinal cells that are exposed to that sunlight. So if you're going to look at this sort of situation, a partial solar eclipse, you want to either be using very good welding glass, or more commonly, they tell you to project the image of the sun on a white sheet of paper so you can see that it's this little crescent. Okay, so we got partial eclipses if you're missing the dot that is fully black. We've got total eclipses if you're in the dot that is fully black. If the eclipse misses, and about half of them do, then we have this sort of situation, which is an annular eclipse. Okay. And I don't know, I think I showed this one last time, but I'll show it again just because it's helpful to remember. The little dot of totality really is pretty small. And it's going to swish along as the Earth rotates. So these eclipses, the solar eclipses, are going to last just a matter of minutes, in contrast to the solar eclipses, which typically last hours and are visible to lots of people. Okay, so we've covered these two unusual guys, those planets. Kind of the next two to think about are Mercury and Venus. So Mercury and Venus have really funny paths on the sky, right? So most things follow exactly the circular pattern. The sun and the moon follow fairly normal patterns. Venus and Mercury follow really kind of odd patterns. And that is to say, they play catch-up. So if this is the sun and this is, say, Venus, it'll move ahead of the sun for a while, and then it'll fall behind the sun, and then it'll catch up to the sun again. It's on one side of the sun or it's on the other side of the sun alternately. And it's never very far from the sun. So I'm trying to avoid explanations for any of this stuff yet. But yeah, as a matter of fact, Mercury and Venus have orbits that are inside of the Earth's orbit. And if there were any other new planets that were inside the Earth's orbit, they would also have the same phenomena. They'd always be pretty much in the same direction as the sun. And it's pretty easy to understand just from, and again, this is not really what I want to talk about. If we're thinking about such a planet, the angle between the sun and that planet, no matter where it is always going to be pretty small. It's never going to be 180 degrees away from the sun. In contrast to something like Mars, these are so-called superior planets. In that case, it's possible for Mars to be 180 degrees from the sun, to have a full Mars, as it were. Or Mars can be in the same direction as the sun. Okay, so these inferior planets, Venus and Mercury, they're playing back and forth game with the sun. And you remember that if we have an object like that is to the left of the sun, if you think about holding that thing up, hold that map up, and aim north to north and put the sun on the horizon, such an object, planet, or star would be visible at sunset. It would not be visible at sunrise. And of course, during the day, it would be above the horizon, but you couldn't see it because it would be too bright outside. So these objects, these inferior planets, Mercury and Venus, they are visible at sunset when they're on that side of the sun, and they're visible at sunrise when they're on that side of the sun. And they alternate. So the phenomena that you would see if you were watching these guys. So here you'd be looking at sunset and you would see these dots that are relatively close to the ecliptic. Like any planets, they don't have an exactly repeating path, but they're always close to the ecliptic. Mercury would be closer to the sun than Venus. Mercury can get as far as 30 degrees from the sun. Venus can get as far as 45 degrees from the sun. So if you were watching at sunset, you would see nothing the first night, and maybe a week later you would see Venus pretty close to the horizon. And then as time went on, week by week by week, Venus would get further and further from the sun. And then it would, again, get close to the sun, week by week by week. And it turns out that Venus is brightest in our sky when it's in this process of having reached its maximum elongation. It's in the process of coming back towards the sun. When Venus disappears from the sky at sunset, then a few weeks later, Venus will appear again close to the horizon at sunrise. It'll reach a maximum elongation of about 45 degrees, and then it'll go back into hiding. And a few weeks later, it'll come out on this side of the sun where we can then see it at sunrise. So these things are sometimes called morning stars or evening stars because they're usually visible in one or the other. If it's right at the location of the sun, then it's going to be hard to see. But they alternate between being visible at sunset and being visible at sunrise. Okay. So this is a very complicated path for these planets, right? The zigzag motion back and forth, never very far from the sun. Never in opposition to the sun, which is another way of saying 180 degrees from the sun. Pretty commonly in conjunction with the sun, which means in the same direction as the sun. So conjunction is like a new moon, same direction as the sun. Opposition is like a full moon in the opposite direction as the sun. Quadrature, when you're 90 degrees from the sun, is kind of the same thing as the quarter phase moons, third quarter and first quarter. Okay, so on average, Mercury and Venus are moving at the same rate as the sun, right? Because they never get very far ahead or behind, so the longer number of laps we cover, the closer the average speed of Mercury is to the average speed of the sun. So for the so-called superior planets, and that's Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, and if the ancients knew about the other planets, it would be true of them too. But the other planets aren't particularly bright, so they hadn't been picked out by the ancients. So these guys have, kind of to first approximation, I guess I would say simpler motion than Venus and Mercury have. But there are then kind of additional complications. So mostly what's happening to these superior planets is they're moving close to the ecliptic a lot slower than the sun. Mostly what these planets are doing, if you're not taking very careful track of them, mostly what you'll see is that they're just going close to the ecliptic at a slower rate than the sun. So if we start with, say, Mars being in conjunction with the sun, of course we're not going to see Mars. A month later or so, the sun will have moved on a little bit and Mars will hardly moved at all. And under these circumstances, with Mars being on the right in this diagram, it's going to be visible as a morning star, close to the sun. As time goes on, the angle between Mars and the sun is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. So eventually we'll reach the point where Mars is rising just as the sun is setting, and vice versa, kind of the equivalent of a full moon, 180 degrees between Mars and the sun. So again, that's called opposition, and it turns out that Mars looks the brightest that it's ever going to be when it's in opposition. So it's always fairly bright, but it's quite noticeably brighter, way brighter when it's in opposition than not. So approximately speaking, everything rises in the east and sets in the west. So just as with the sun, and these guys are going to be close to the ecliptic, so they're always going to be pretty close to the sun. Just as with the sun, if it's rising during the winter, it's going to be rising south of east. If it's rising during the summer, it's going to be rising north of east. It's always on the ecliptic, close to the ecliptic, within a few degrees of the ecliptic, in the region we call the zodiac. So if you are amused by looking at your horoscope when they talk about Mars being in Capricorn, Capricorn is one of the constellations that's near the ecliptic, so they mean that Mars is in that constellation now and for the next several months. You remember when we looked on the flip side of your star finders, you could see what constellation the major planets were going to be in for various periods of time. Okay, so mostly what the superior planets are doing is moving slower than the sun does on the ecliptic, near the ecliptic, and so as a result, they're going to get left behind by the sun and they're going to appear as morning stars. Then they're going to get 180 degrees from the sun, in which case they're going to be setting as the moon, as setting as the sun rises, or rising as the sun sets. And then eventually what's going to happen is the sun is going to catch up to them. And so now they'll be visible in our evening sky. But as time goes on, the sun moves faster than the planet, the angle between those guys is going to get closer and closer and closer until eventually we have that planet moving into the glare of the sun and not being visible again because it's in conjunction with the sun. And then the cycle will repeat. Okay, and the main difference between Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn is kind of the rate of speed on the celestial sphere. So Mars goes the fastest, and then Jupiter the second fastest, Saturn the third fastest. Something like Pluto hardly moves at all. Okay, so mostly what happens is they have this slow motion on the celestial sphere. If we look in greater detail, it turns out that there are complications. So this is actual data that was taken AD 133. And we see here the gradual motion of this planet, which is Saturn, from first visibility in the morning sky to last visibility in the evening sky. Right? So here's that planet slowly moving along the ecliptic. And notice, first of all, that we're talking about relatively small things, right? So this is about 10 degrees, which would be typically about one constellation. So Saturn is more or less in the same constellation all year. And again, we're talking about basically a year between first visibility and last visibility. And what's happening is we've got this little loop-de-loop. So it's not that the planets are steadily moving slowly on the ecliptic. It's a two steps forward, one step back sort of situation. It's a relatively small thing. That is to say, you know, this whole backwards loop is only a few degrees wide, right? Only a few times the size of the moon. So unless you're looking for it very carefully, it'll look pretty much like it's moving steadily from one constellation to the next over the decades. But in fact, it's going kind of like this. Two steps forward, one step back. So these backward steps, they're called retrogrades. Normal motion, which is the motion that the sun goes, the motion that the moon goes, that's called prograde. When something goes backwards, we think of it as being unusual. That's retrograde motion. Okay. Now, I didn't much emphasize it, but the inferior planets are also going retrograde when the sun is more than catching up to them, right? Because they're on one side of the sun and the other, so they're also going backwards in the process of staying more or less along with the sun. But it's kind of a different thing because these guys have this retrograde loop. The center of this retrograde motion is listed as theta, which is when they're in opposition. So they're going backwards when they are most visible, which is when they are rising at sunset. And are typically the brightest. Although Saturn and Jupiter are always pretty bright. The change in brightness is mostly noticeable with Mars, which is quite noticeably brighter in opposition than in conjunction. Right, so here's kind of the overall picture. Year after year after year, we have retrograde loop after retrograde loop as the planet moves along, more or less along, you can see not exactly along the ecliptic. And it's never exactly reoccurring its path, right? So the moon pretty closely is on the same great circle this month as last month. These guys are basically never going to repeat that exact path. Okay, so if you try and kind of put together what this motion must mean, you kind of come up with something a little bit like this. And so this is actually data from the early 1700s. So presumably the reason Jupiter is brighter is because it's closer. So with this sort of setup, when Jupiter is going backwards. That's also when it's closest to the Earth. Okay. Now, this should all sound pretty confusing to you because it sounds nothing like what you were told in high school. But remember, I'm not trying to come up with an explanation. I'm just trying to say how things work. Okay, so questions about what you would actually see if you just followed these planets. So Jupiter right now, we just barely saw it at the end of the last lab. But because the Sun is going to be catching up with Jupiter, the angle between the Sun and Jupiter is going to be decreasing. So for the second lab, we will have Jupiter in our skies. Regular motion, correct. Every superior planet has these backward loops. And the size of the backward loops gets smaller, as we would say, the further the planet is from the Sun. So Mars has the biggest backward loop, and then Jupiter, Saturn, and that's all that was known to the ancients. So not only are the, as we would say, an order of distance of the Sun, not only are they moving slower on the celestial sphere, they have, you might say, more and more regular motion. The retrograde loops are smaller and smaller and smaller as we go out. We do have kind of the oddity that you would think Jupiter is very prominent in our skies. And you might think that because it's so bright, it's closer than Mars, but it's not the case. I mean, Mars is physically smaller. Even though it's a lot closer than Jupiter, it's not as bright as Jupiter is. Jupiter wins by having big brightness. And again, kind of to set the stage for some models, you know, lest you think that all of this is kind of crazy, when I talk about the Sun moving on the celestial sphere, you know, tomorrow or next time what I'll be saying is this is really what's happening, right? The Earth is moving along, so it looks like the Sun is in Sagittarius, and then it's in Capricorn, and then it's in Aquarius. But we don't worry about models of how the universe is working. We just plot the positions of these planets and stars on the celestial sphere. And again, all of them are going to rise and set because the celestial sphere is rotating once every 24 hours. All of these motions that we've been talking about in the celestial sphere are very small from a day-to-day point of view. Right? So if the Sun was in, you can see from this sort of diagram, in order for the Sun to appear to go from one constellation to another, we're talking about a month, basically. So all day today, the Sun, and all week today, the Sun is presumably in some particular constellation. And you know that because you know that these tick marks that denote the position of the Sun are pretty close together. So don't think that the rising and the setting of the Sun has to do with its motion on the celestial sphere. That all has to do with the celestial sphere's rotation. Okay, so I mean, the ancients were interested in predicting the future locations of the stars. And so we need some sort of model that would explain these kind of funny observations. And the model that gained prominence was a model that I think is the most obvious one. Let's see if I have a slide of it. And it's called a geocentric model because it sure seems like the Earth isn't moving. So we have this point of view then that here's one, but I should have a better one in a second. Maybe I'll just have to suffer. Ah, here we go. Well, let's start with this one. So this is labeled epicycle. If the apparent motion of Jupiter, you know, if you actually just plot where Jupiter is in the sky, looks like that, the most obvious way of generating this sort of motion is with something like this. where you say that Jupiter is on this circle going around, and this circle is on another circle that's going around. So we get the backward loop of Jupiter as because we're on this piece of the path. Okay, so epicycles are these little circles which sit on these bigger circles, which are called deferents, and the whole thing is spinning around. So the average motion of Jupiter, the progressive motion of Jupiter, the motion of Jupiter over the years through the various constellations, that's due to the center of the epicycle moving. The little backward and forward pieces, those are due to the motion of Jupiter along the epicycle. Okay, and so that's the data you're trying to explain. I think it's reasonably clear that's going to work pretty well. So here's kind of a bigger picture of it. So how do we model exactly these motions? Well, let's start with the most obvious thing, which is the sun. So we don't need one of these epicycles for the sun because the sun has progressive motion. But you remember that the motion of the sun isn't exactly uniform. Sometimes the sun is moving a little bit faster, right? That turns out to be the case about there. Sometimes the sun is moving a little bit slower. That turns out to be about there. So how can we make that happen in this model of how the sun works? Well, so the way the ancients did it was by the following technique. They put, this is of course a circle. Sun's motion is a circle around the Earth. They put the Earth off center, and they said that the motion of the sun was uniform, not about the center of the circle, but about this off-center point. So this whole construction is called the equant. The center of the circle is in the center of the segment between the Earth and this point about which the motion of the sun is uniform. Okay, so if you think about how that's going to work, if we have so let me draw my circle first. So here's going to be my equant point. Here's going to be the Earth. That's what I mean to be the center. If you think about this thing as going at a uniform rate, because the planet at this point is relatively close to the rotation point, it's going to have fewer miles per hour. Whereas when it's way over here and further from the center, the same rate of rotation, the same number of RPMs is going to lead to a faster velocity. Not only that, but the same velocity further from the Earth is going to be a smaller angular velocity. On the other hand, at this point here where the sun has more miles per hour and is also closer to the Earth, it's going to seem to move faster. All right, so this is the story of the fly that's going a few miles an hour close to your head, seems to be going through big angles. Those cars that you know are going 70 miles an hour on I-94 seem to be moving pretty slowly in angle. Okay, so we have a double phenomena. Here the sun is fewer miles per hour and it's more distant, so it's going to seem to move a smaller angle than the sun is going to seem to move here. Okay. And it turns out that this is an excellent approximation for the actual data that shows where the sun is at any particular time. It works really well. So having great success with the sun, kind of the plan is to continue that same process for the other planets. So the other planets are going to have their epicycles moving uniformly as viewed by this equant. They're going to be going in circles that's going to cause the apparent loop-the-loop motion that we know is the retrograde motion. For the inferior planets, the plan is basically just to tie the this motion of the deferent to the motion of the sun. So the picture is that. So here's the Earth, here's the Sun, here's, say, Venus, So the same line that connects the Earth to the Sun, that same line is going to connect to the center of the epicycle of Venus's. So as a result, as Venus goes around in its epicycle, sometimes it's going to be in front of the Sun, sometimes it's going to be behind the Sun, but it's always going to be pretty close to the Sun. So, you know, without benefit of calculators, the Greeks punched through these numbers, and they could easily calculate the positions of the planets moderately closely, within a few degrees. And remember that the size of the moon is half a degree, so within a few moon diameters, they could predict the future location of these planets. So it's a pretty good system. But it's not the final system. So kind of let me pre-stage what the overall plan is, and it's what's in the reading. We're going to be focusing then on the kind of 99 years where we go from the system I've just described, the so-called geocentric system, to the system that you were taught in grade school, where the Sun is at the center of the solar system and the planets are moving around it. So we're going to be talking about a lot of these people, and usually we start with Copernicus. So Copernicus was the guy who wrote the book at the very end of his life that dealt with the possibility of the Sun being fixed and the planets moving. He wasn't the first. That is to say, the Greeks had always known that you could have this alternative view, but there didn't seem to be any point to it. The end of this period is Newton and his published work, the Principia Mathematica, that describes how it all works in excruciating detail. So if you want to send a probe to Mars, all you need is what's in the Principia. It's perfectly adequate to explain any motion that you would talk about in the solar system. Okay, so with that, we'll call it quits.